You'll see your requirement for this course. We'll have a midterm and a final, very simple course. We'll all have a class for them. We don't get a quiz every day to keep us going. And you'll have a paper, major research paper. You notice that the syllabus calls for both for David Alford, David Heiser's book, because that was originally ordered for it. Now, here are on one of the following topics: science and a miracle, the beginning of science and miracle, the beginning of life, the origins of modern scientific thinking, Genesis, material evolution. Now, I'm going to talk about a paper. Now, that's very broad. You may want to focus in on something within me. Those are the broad areas. I'm on a paper in one of those areas. Okay. I don't know how to do this, but let's look at our course description. And you'll see that where we're going on this. This course is set of the four following issues: the history and character of the scientific method, the biblical view of the natural order and how that view relates to the scientific method, the history and character of the conflict between Christianity and science, theistic and materialistic views on origins. That's where we get into evolution specifically. Okay. Let me begin by saying, any questions? Yes. Any questions on the structure of the course? Very simple. You want to begin your research each quarter, make it run on research paper. You're going to begin your research paper very soon, I would think. Now, let me say by way of introduction, I think this course is one of the most important ones in the curriculum. You all think that every course is important, but for different reasons. If we're going to be evangelistic and reach people who are very much a part of the intellectual culture that is our world, you're going to have to know something about this subject. And it is the one that is constantly changing. I have to read more to keep myself up in this course than anything I teach. When I teach the history of Protestantism, you know, 16th century, 16th century hasn't changed much. Put a hand in there, you know. And while there are new interpretations, the other requirement a lot of reading is my World Bible, because of constant information coming from the archaeologists. But in this field, where archaeology informs the discipline, it's ancient history, and in this field requires more reading to stay up on it. That is, what you know becomes outdated more quickly than any other area. And this more than ancient history, it was really a shift. For instance, one of the things we're going to see is that the theory of evolution, and this is one of my big gripes, I talk about this all the time. That for instance, if you go to the modern, you pick up a modern textbook. I've got a copy of the biology textbook that has not yet been introduced and not yet being used in my son's high school, but will be used in the next cycle. Well, I've got to get an advanced copy of it. It's already outdated. You can study. Let me say this to you, that most of the time you had biology in high school, you remember much about it, you had at least something to do with evolution in it. I want you to know that when you studied that, when you studied that, that view of evolution, that concept, that scheme, that paradigm, had already been rejected by the leaders in the field. The most interesting thing, you see this gap, it's disgusting, within the creationist, evolutionist textbook, court trial in Louisiana, that Jay Gould from Harvard went down there and testified in court to make sure just one theory of origins was taught in the public school. He knows very well what that theory of origins is taught, understand? He knew what would be taught. He went to court, he traveled down there and testified to make sure that view was taught. He himself rejects that view. He has written against it. And if you want to, rather than have the two models, or rather than have both creationism, the creation model, and the evolution model taught, he, rather than that, he doesn't have the view taught that he himself has come out against instead of the other word. So, you see what I'm saying? So, I have to, and actually, that's why some of the statements in the syllabus are very general, and I'm going to be adding some things to the syllabus, but things that I found necessary to incorporate in this course since the syllabus came out. Now, I'm trying to underscore the importance of this field. Now, the other thing, by way of introduction, is that this course is intellectually tougher than any course that you'll take here, perhaps. Well, no, that's not true. I think there are some courses that just take more thinking. I think some of Dean Chambers' courses, where he deals with things where you really don't know, philosophy and ethics, you have to go into your thinking. You know, in history, we do have, as you know, when you did my history course, we do analytical work, but not nearly as much as we're going to do here, because of the nature of the subjects. So, what I want to say in this, in connection with this, is that if you have a question, ask it. If you don't understand what I'm saying, don't sit there and let it go over your head and then wonder what happens at exam time or any time. Ask, and I'll go over it several times. The syllabus is not very thick, you know. Those of you who get in town from me, you probably notice that there isn't a whole lot there. You say, well, is that going to be a 4-hour study for all these weeks? The answer is yes. You go very slowly. So we'll make some statements, but I insist on this. As you ask me, do not be embarrassed. The only stupid question is the one that you don't know the answer to, but are too embarrassed to ask. That's a stupid one. No such thing in my opinion as a stupid question. Well, I'll take that back. I've had a couple of stupid questions I got in my day, but not generally so. So ask. Okay, any questions on the structure of the course? Yes. That's a stupid question.
How are our examinations going to be? Are they going to be like what?
I do not know yet. I'll see how I teach it. See how it goes. I'll try to examine it in a way that it reflects the way the course goes. I say that because I taught this before. This is the largest number I've ever had. And that's bad, and that this course requires a lot of discussion. It evokes a lot of discussion. And the more students you have, the less, the more limitations that takes on everybody. But so let me see how it goes. Okay, any other questions? Let's begin. We begin with definitions. Now, this course is on the history and logic of science. Well, this is not a science course. We are looking at the structure of scientific thought and the history and logic of scientific thought and how that is to be understood in the light of biblical theism. First of all, a definition. Science, I use Martin Luther's definition here, which is good as any. By science, you mean the knowledge of the natural world obtained by sense interaction with that world. Let's look at that. It is knowledge of the natural world gained by sense interaction. What is sense interaction? Pardon? No, not directly. Observation. Empiricism, right. In other words, you see it, you feel it, you weigh it, you count it, you hear it, you taste it. That which comes through the five senses. It is knowledge, science is knowledge of the natural world obtained by sense interaction with that world. Observation, experimentation, that sort of thing. Science is concerned only with the physical world. That which is outside space and time is not properly within the domain of science. Now, one of the things we're going to see, now listen to me, here's the language we're using. This is the standard language of this discipline. That when science goes beyond sense interaction of the natural world and begins to make proclamations, it ceases to be science and becomes what has come to be called scientism. And if you read through this field, it's very difficult to always draw a distinction between science and scientism. You got that? So when science begins to make, when a scientist begins to make proclamations as a scientist, and offering it as a scientist, not as a man, but as a scientist, on anything outside the natural order, he stops being a, he stops practicing science, whether he knows it or not, and begins to practice scientism. For instance, what does science have to say about ethics? What a man ought to do? Nothing. You know, the science, if I reach in this desk and I and struck Mr. McManus on the head, science would have much to say about that act. A medical doctor might write a long report, an autopsy, I hope, on the physical effects of that blow, the effects on the skull, the effects on the brain, and a physicist might compute the weight and the arc and the momentum and compute how many pounds per square inch of force lands on his head. You hear that? A psychologist, in psychology, in my opinion, that borders science, it might raise the question of why I did it. But science would have, and as science, would have nothing to say about whether I should have done it or not. Now, a scientist speaking as a man might say, you shouldn't have done that. Did they hit the poor fellow? But he's not speaking as a scientist. You understand that? So that's a very clear illustration, I think, of what we're talking about. Science can say nothing about the supernatural. I'll make a reference, put your notes here. I'm not going to take time to go over. C.S. Lewis's God in the Dock, an anthology has been published in our library, you should be familiar with it, God in the Dock. Pages 72 and following, you have a very fine discussion of this. Science can say nothing about the supernatural. Why? By definition, it cannot. That is, a scientist, science. Now, keep in mind, I'm really using bad, I'm doing bad thinking here, and it's a shortcut, an intellectual shortcut. But when I say science does this is a common way of speaking, that is in logic called, in linguistics it's called personification. I'm personifying science as if it existed as a person, but it's not true. Science does nothing. Science does nothing. People who are involved and women who are involved in science say things. But we're dealing in the abstract here, and I'm personifying. Science has no way of knowing whether a miracle ever did happen, ever could happen, or ever will happen. Why? Because by definition, a miracle is outside the realm of science. For instance, science cannot prescribe, proscribe, let me put it this way, I'm going to put it backwards. The laws of nature, as we call them, are prescriptive. The laws of nature are descriptive. Science is fundamentally descriptive. It's a descriptive discipline. It describes what happens. It makes predictions based on, makes physical predictions based upon what is upon observation and description of what has happened.
The laws of nature cannot, they are descriptive. They are not prescriptive.
We may come back to this in another connection.
They're not prescriptive. They cannot talk about what shall happen. They are not proscriptive.
They cannot say what can or cannot happen. They simply describe what does happen or has happened.
You said the law of nature, but you consider gravity the law of nature.
Gravity, yes.
If I drop the rock, isn't that prescriptive? If I drop the rock, it will, it is going to expand out of the building.
It simply describes what normally happens.
If I step in the head, it does hit the ground. And the law of gravity cannot help. Can I predict that? And I think that one. All they can do is describe what normally happens if there's no eruption. If nobody steps in,
it cannot say what cannot, can or cannot happen. It cannot proscribe him. It cannot say this cannot happen. And it cannot prescribe. It cannot say this must happen. All it can do is dropping the rock. All you can say, all the science can say is, if you drop the rock, all it can say is, what normally happens, what can be probably expected to have a high degree of probability, if nothing interrupts. Well, for instance, a supernatural event, like a miracle, is by definition an exception. That's what makes it a miracle. And if you studied this in any of the Chambers classes, this is an approach you shouldn't have. This is an overlap. So that you often hear somebody say, well, that people used to believe, you know, in a pretty scientific age, people believed in miracles, but now we know that miracles can happen. Oh, on what basis? How do we know? Well, it's like saying, well, you know, people could believe in the virgin birth back then, but now we know genetics. We know about eggs and sperm, white tapes. They didn't know that back then. No. Then why was Joseph going to divorce Mary? And why did Mary say, angel says, you are going to have a baby? And she says, how can this be? The revised standard version here, man. So, the revised standard version has Mary saying, how can that be? Since I'm not a husband.
Angel said, well, come on now.
Yeah, that Mary didn't say, well, Greek is possible. So look up the word of man. What she didn't say, well, that's not possible. Mary didn't say, oh, I can't have a baby, I don't have a husband. She said, what Mary said was, how can this be, seeing I have not known a man? She was a Jew scientist, she knew what to do. So, this is why I think, well, now we know. No, you see. Science cannot speak of the supernatural because the supernatural, by definition, is outside the realm. All that science can do is describe what normally happens and make projections based upon knowledge of what normally happens. But that's the whole point of the supernatural, of a miracle, isn't it? That it's an exception. And science simply has no way of dealing with the exceptions. And a miracle, in some way, is an exception to the natural course of things, which is what makes it miracle. Science can say nothing about aesthetics. That is, science can, through science, you look at the sunset, you can gain information about the mathematics of refraction and how certain colors are filtered out, and thus we see other colors. But the judgment that a sunset is beautiful is a non-scientific judgment, that is aesthetics. You can take a beautiful painting, and science can analyze the paint and tell you what kind of pigments are there and how much lead you got in the paint. And how long it's likely to stick to the canvas and retain its but science cannot say whether it's a good picture or not, whether it's good art. And science already said it's beyond ethics. It cannot say that I should not have struck Mr. McManus with my glove. Okay. In its narrowest definition, science speaks only of a methodology. It is narrow. Now, you notice the definition I use is food, which is not the narrowest definition. In the broadest possible definition, science is knowledge. In the narrowest definition, the technical definition, science is not the knowledge, it is the method that's used to arrive at that knowledge. It is the method involved in this sensory interaction by which we arrive at our conclusions. So science primarily is a method in its narrowest definition, at its heart, at its base. You got that? Technically, science is not a set of conclusions. Science is the procedure, the method, whereby those conclusions are arrived at. And here are the requirements and the steps for science. Observation. You look at some hypothesis, and you guess about what might be true. Repeated observation or experiment. Verification or accommodation. You make others verify, accommodate to other sciences, to the conclusions from other fields of science. And then prediction. Predict. Sometimes make very good predictions, sometimes very simple. That's the scientific method. What are the limitations of the scientific method? Even a successful theoretical model is limited in the accuracy and range of its application. That is, the conclusions arrived at by the scientific methodology are often tentative, and the application of those conclusions is even more restrictive. Because when you start applying the knowledge that you gain by the scientific method, are y'all with me? I'm talking to myself. When you start applying it, you very quickly move beyond the realm of science. And we're going to see that especially the question of origin. Well, you take one step beyond it if you're into theology. Quickly. Here is the process of the scientific method. A hypothesis means that there is no evidence, a guess, a surmise, an idea. It's a hypothesis. A theory is scanty but insufficient evidence. For a theory, you have to have a little more evidence than you do for a hypothesis. But it's still a theory. It is insufficient evidence. Now, the big jump is between theory and fact. In the recent school text controversy at Tallahassee last week, our governor very heroically climbed the fence on and said, "You keep riding the fence on this, that's the way." But, he's going to delay his decision. But the lady who's in charge of that, she made this statement for the newspaper. That they didn't want creationism taught. Why? Because creationism is belief. What she said. Evolution is fact. Well, of course, the problem with that is that that goes beyond what the real experts in the field are aware of. Maybe that's a half-baked, uninformed. Yes, I'm talking about the. You read the literature of the real leaders in the field who are evolutionists, they don't look back. They don't go that far. You know, just cut it off and look back. For instance, you illustrate this with somebody, I'm going to say, well, you know, evolution
as we all know, is supported by the law of nature. Not exception. Just name one. Which law? Well, you know. Well, which one? Name one. There's never an answer to that question. So it's not. Now, the real problem is when you, for an unscientific reason, here's what's happened with evolution. Well, first of all, let's look at the fact. Let's say my statement is, fact is what we define. Increase in evidence, qualitatively and quantitatively enough. You got that? Enough evidence and enough. It's not just an accumulation of evidence, but the accumulation of good evidence to convince the intellect. Evidence of a nature to overwhelm the power of the intellect to reject it. Now, many things we know are established by the scientific evidence, the dropping of the stone. We said if we drop the stone and nothing interrupts the process, nothing steps in, would you bet your life it would go down and not up?
Yeah.
Why? Yes. Well, because that's the way it's always happened, for sure. But the problem with evolution, and I keep coming back to it because this is the sore thumb in this whole business. The problem with evolution is that evolution represents premature suffering. Got that? Before something can be called a fact, the evidence qualitatively and quantitatively has to be of such number and such weight that it overwhelms the power of the intellect to resist. The third evolution represents premature surrender. On why? Because for unscientific reasons. Premature surrender. For unscientific reasons. That is the reason when people call evolution a fact, their intellect has surrendered before the battle has been lost, as it were. They're waving the white flag again, while they're ready to do what they want to, for all kinds of reasons for doing it, but not scientific reasons. It's kind of like the fellow, kind of like being in love. Did you ever, you fellows ever have a friend who was in love with a girl, and she just loved the girlfriend? I mean, everybody can see it but him. And you try to tell him? He probably lost a friend. Why? Because he can't see anything but her good points. And to her, if she has any faults, he just can't see them, or they come disguised as virtues. Why? Because it is the love. That's why I recommend, by the way, before you take a date, fast for 2 weeks. You see things more quickly. I'm not kidding. You got that? So a guy who's in love tends to surrender prematurely. His critical faculties don't work. Instead of going, he goes, he just head over heels and emotional and spends money he doesn't have. And well, the reason evolution came to be accepted as the unifying theory of modern science is because not because people were in love, but because people were in hate. Romans 1 describes that hate. Even as they refuse to have God in their knowledge. It's as emotional and irrational as romantic love is sometimes. You got that? The world is in hate with God. It's coined a phrase. Why? You see, it's not a matter. There are all kinds of personal and philosophical, theological reasons why people very often don't want God to be the origin of the universe. Why?
Because
just leave it at that, would be a problem. You've got God, that means my existence is a derivative existence. That means what? Accountability. That means authority. Maybe it means repentance. If I can't be the God of my own world, it's probably a don't see it so. The revolution, in my opinion, represents premature surrender. It was a fact. Now, and then law. The fact to be observed and demonstrated to be repeatable and to be uniform, experimental reproducibility is the character of scientific law. And by the way, there are very few scientific laws. Very few. Why? Because very few things, by the very nature, are experimentally reproducible. And as Karl Popper and others have pointed out, that the evolution cannot ever be anything but a theory, because by its very nature, it cannot be experimentally reproducible. All that evolution can ever be is a theory of biology. I'm sorry, a philosophy of biology. Karl Popper, one of the leading philosophers of science, not a creationist. Karl Popper, the leading philosopher of science. You perhaps in one of Dean Chambers' classes, you came across your name, you should have. Of course, you've taken it, but it's also on the left. Karl Popper said that by its very nature, evolution can only be in theory, never be a law, because it is not experimentally reproducible by its very nature. The best you can show is what might have happened. Why? Because by its very nature, nobody can go back and look at it and watch it happen. And you cannot experimentally reproduce a one-time event. All you can show is what might have happened. For instance, many people think that if the scientists ever create life in the test tube, to use an old cliche, that will prove that the Bible is false and will prove anything of the sort. All it could ever prove is what might have happened. So creation by its very nature, and by the way, it's also true for the creationists. The biblical doctrine of creation, is it a scientific fact? Certainly is not. It's not a scientific fact. It's a philosophy of biology. See, creationism is a philosophy of biology. It's much more than that, but as it touches the biological or the living order, it's a philosophy of biology. As far as it covers that ground. But evolution is a philosophy of biology. I don't mind the evolutionist telling me that my position is a philosophy of biology. I just don't want him telling me that it isn't. We're on the same ground. We establish our position on the basis of probabilities, not on observation, understand? Because just like the evolutionists cannot go back and experiment and watch it or observe it or experimentally reproduce it, what happened in the beginning. So neither can we go back and experimentally reproduce or observe Genesis 1:1. It cannot be done by our nature. Do you understand that? We need to understand the area of our discussion. Yes.
What are a couple of examples of laws?
Well, law of such things, well, certain basic laws, like laws of centrifugal force, which are computable, predictable, gravity. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The laws of thermodynamics, the first law of conservation of matter, the second law of the degradation of matter, entropy, increase in entropy or probability. Those are laws, that is, are universally recognized, always reproducible, utterly predictable. You want some more examples? Those are examples of basic laws. We also speak of the laws of mathematics. Certain mathematical combinations produce certain results without fail. 2 and 2 equals 4 at all times under all conditions. No matter what you got 2 of, you get 2 more of them, you got 4.
Or you got too many things else you got for.
Those laws have, say, the laws of refraction.
Light bends a certain way. If you set up a prism, it will dissolve light into its primary colors always. Always the same colors. It's a simple observation. Repeat it to 1,000 times in high school chemistry lab. That's what I'm talking about. And there aren't very many of those, by the way. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Yes.
You said that creation is also a biological.
In the forest, creation touches the biological order, but the biological, I mean, living thing, as opposed to non-living world. Really?
Well, the question I've got is, the view I'm looking at is that it's a biology, but wouldn't we have kind of certainty as to our position if we're given the fact of revelation that
no, that's a good point.
God has told us that the world has begun in such a way.
But it's not in the people by that what he's saying is, since we have a revelation, do we not have a higher degree of certainty? My answer is not biological certainty, not in the area of biology. Then you move out to another area. That is you're in the area, for instance, of philosophy and theology. Then you get the question of, that's the difference between the logical. For instance, is there a divine revelation? Is the Bible a divine revelation? Then you approach that systematically. The possibility, probability, and desirability of divine revelation. Is divine revelation possible? Yes. Is it probable? Yes. Is it desirable? Yes. Therefore, that since it is both possible, probable, and desirable, the likelihood is that if the probabilities exist on the side, that there would be a divine revelation if there's a God. Is there a God? Possible. Is it probable? And the probabilities are there. You're arguing a probable position. Therefore, is it probable that Genesis 1:1 is credible? Yes. How about the document? Then again, the historical criticism. I mean the canon of historical criticism is that. How old are the documents? Not historical criticism in the theological sense. I'm talking about the canon of historical criticism. Does it represent what it is, the kind of document it claims to be? So it's a whole body of discussion and investigation that establishes, but it's not biology. It's not biology. See, if you're using a biology, total chance of organic evolution is in biological and philosophy of biology. The biological order. So, therefore, you see, in rational thought, Bush, question and answer have to be homogeneous. Did you understand what I just said? The problem and the solution have to be homogeneous of the same kind. That is, you cannot expect a mathematical question answer to a historical question.
Well, what I was looking at was the end product of uncertainty of the fact.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Because we've got not only a biological avenue to determine creation, but also revelation.
I think you're right.
Revelation doesn't have that.
Right. Right. You're saying because we have revelation, apart from observation of the biological order, we have the added certainty. My answer is yes, but it's not. But the other comes from outside the field of biology. Comes to bear from the outside. You don't have more of the biological argument, that's what I'm saying. It's important to keep this, it's important in thinking. One of the characteristics of intellectual maturity is you keep your categories straight. And by the way, that's one of the things evolutionists have never been able to do. They ask all that they can't seem to keep their problem and their solution homogeneous. They all the time are asking, well, people do this all the time, can you prove there's a God? Show me God and I'll believe in it. You see, let's keep the categories straight. And that's what I'm saying. The philosophy of biology, evolution, so is creation, and so far as creation examines
same evidence and tries to come to what I consider to be more probable conclusion. Okay, now, you understand the relationship between theory, fact, and law? The critical, I'm going to repeat now, the critical fact, the critical jump there is between theory and fact. And we must not make a premature surrender. And interestingly enough, in other areas, modern science has often done a pretty good job. One of the things I've maintained over the years is that if NASA, for instance, used the same quality of science as the evolutionists did, we would never have Challenger 7 blowing up. We would never have had Challenger 7 at all. They would have never gotten the first rocket past Biblo back in the 1950s. I'm very serious about that. They never got anything off the ground if they use the same quality. That is, if in the field of astrophysics, what we call space science, if theory had surrendered to fact as easily as it has surrendered in the field of total chance organic evolution, we wouldn't have these beautiful sleek flying machines. That's the kind of Rube Goldberg Model A contraption that wouldn't have gone anywhere. Okay, now, let's take our break now, because I've got something I want to give you some notes about it in this edition of the syllabus, and then we'll move on with the physics kind of stuff. We'll start about 22 Kelvin. Back. This is from a book. This is the source of this. One of the things that I'll, in dealing with evolution, one of the things I hope to teach you in a way that, in this class, in a way that you'll never forget, is that in dealing with the theory of evolution, it is not a matter of creation scientists writing arguments on the other pole, on the other side of this goal, evolutionary scientists writing arguments. That is not the nature of the discussion. Whenever I deal with it in seminars or in book reviews, deal with evolution, I never ever, almost never, sometimes never ever, use material from the creationist viewpoint. You don't have to. The main body of literature which provides the arguments which show the extreme fallibility of the theory of total chance, trans-Pacific evolution, and all the trouble of transmutation and so on, comes from non-creation. The debate today is not between creationists and evolutionists. Now that debate is going on. But, for instance, some of you may know this, about 6 years ago, I succeeded in getting a textbook on human evolution, physical anthropology, removed from the state textbook list. I was told at the time it was the first time anybody ever got one taken off the list. I was curious about what I was told that. I did it with the Eagle Forums organization asking me to review the book, and it was a standard book on evolution, Salson was the author's name. And I wrote about an 11-page critical evaluation of it, selective critical evaluation of it, showing that it was outdated, improbable, that in many cases it was simple nonsense. Documented, sent it in, I didn't even go up there. The committee read it and removed the book off the list. I sent a copy to the office, but it probably cost me $15,000, more. He's only that much, never heard of me, but you got that? I just presented a body of data, hard data, which I show this book is defect scientifically. I didn't say a word about God. I didn't say a word about creationism. Never a word. I simply showed the book from a purely scientific viewpoint was defective. I didn't use this one. I did not use a single creationist source. So all the data, all the arguments, which destroy the theory of evolution, do not come from creation. We don't need to do that. I know the body of literature there. I'm simply saying, whenever I teach seminar, I had a seminar a couple of years ago in Pennsylvania on evolution weekend seminar. I was careful never to use a single source from the creation. And had a high school teacher, a history teacher, and I never said I was going to do it. And then the weekend, he came up and said, I know this, that you use any creations, use your sources. He said, I really appreciate that. He picked up on it. You get my point? So you need to be aware of that. Isn't that different?
What about non-creations? They always have to use non-creations.
What do you mean?
I mean, do they ever go to creation material?
No.
Yeah.
Wouldn't. Here's an example of it. Here's this book is that in 1971. That's pretty far back as far as this year ago. And this has been reprinted by Gamble. I sent off books and had to wait a long time. Now, this is in our library in the hardback version. It's used to be okay. Now, what this is to explain the nature of what I'm about to give you a perspective on it. Norman Macbeth is not a creationist. He's an attorney with a very fine mind, and he had some kind of breakthrough. He was a very successful attorney. And since you look at the bibliography, he went done his homework. And he had a physical breakdown. And the doctor put him to bed, put him out of commission. He had to sit around for a few months to recuperate. And while he was, he'd always had an interest in this subject. In my Neo Darwinism, general theory of evolution was taught. And so he had to do something. So he took advantage of that those months, or how long it was, maybe more than a year, to study it. And he approached it as an attorney to Darwin retrial. That is, if he pictured a Darwin holding or a Darwinist holding for the theory of evolution, presenting it in court, what's the evidence? What's the evidence? I mean, he took an attorney's approach to it. Does the evidence prove the case? Darwin is retried. He came to the conclusion from his reading through the field, his very good reading, that the case that the evolutionists have not made the case. He is not holding for creation. He's simply saying, you haven't made this case, you need to make another one. This won't hold up. There's the approach. It's got a lot of this stuff in it. Anyway, here's what he says regarding theory and fact and law. He says this, the source is the Norman Macbeth, Darwin Retried, page 7 of Holland. And I'll just read the book. Norman Macbeth, Darwin Retried, and Appeal to Reason is the subtitle. He says this. That many biologists dispute the propriety of a purely skeptical position. They say, how dare you test me? How dare you question my conclusions without PhD? They assert that the skeptic, one who doesn't believe in evolution, is obligated to provide a better theory than the one he attacked. This argument, well, if you can't come up with anything better, you've got to accept mine. Which is exactly how they operate. Thus, Professor Ernst Mayr of Harvard, he's probably he and G. Gary Simpson, two of the top five or six godfathers. Thus, Professor Ernst Mayr of Harvard rules out admittedly valid objections on the ground that the objectors have not advanced a better suggestion. I thought at first this was a personal foible of Mayr's, as he did, you know. He's an attorney. He said,
that won't hold up in debate.
And you can't say, well, my argument may be lousy, but if you don't have a brother, you've got to accept my lousy argument.
He said, first I thought it was just my argument that this is there. But it has recurred in so many other places that it must be a widespread opinion. I cannot take this view seriously. If a theory conflicts with the facts or with reason, it is entitled to no respect. Whether a better theory is offered is irrelevant. You got that? A theory will not fit with the facts of what you can observe, demonstrate, examine. You have to throw it out. You cannot say, well, somebody has a better one, I'll keep it. So he says down this guideline, number one, before we take notes on this, the theory must, we're talking about theory and fact, the theory must be reasonable, not merely the only one or the best one. The theory must be reasonable, not merely the only one or the best one. I'll read it again. The theory, I want you to have this in your notes. This will be in the souls when I revise it. The theory must be reasonable, not merely the only one or the best one. You got that? Second, the scientist must hold his theory with a, quote, light hand. The scientist must hold his theory with a light hand. Quote. What does that mean? He must hold his theory with a light hand. Yes, he must be willing to surrender it if more evidence comes along to make that necessary. Boy, how about that? There's a total chance our guy can't believe anything but a light hand. I mean, they'll hang on to it no matter what. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. This is the history of the thought. Third, the scientist must part with his theory cheerfully. I like that, cheerfully. The moment it is proved to be contrary to any fact, great or small. Well, that's basically a repeat of number two, but he doesn't accept it, so I didn't. The scientist must part with his theory cheerfully the moment it is proved to be contrary to any fact, great or small. Now, that's why he makes this a separate thing. Note this. It does not take a huge, cumbersome, intimidating fact to destroy his theory. It just takes a little bitty. Little bitty one. 60, 50, 90, 90. It only has to be one. That's very important, thinking about this. Because when you read through the field, take my word for it, that all kinds of good, hard fact is simply shell called, I like this, it's called, what's our favorite word to have? They have a technical word and a popular word. The technical word is, it's an anomaly. They come across all kinds of evidence, you know. This is an anomaly, which means what? It means it cannot be what it appears to be, or the whole theory goes out the window. It's an anomaly. When they write it up at the popular level, which the Reader's Digest or the common newspaper or in the high school textbook, it gets to be mystery. Same thing. Mystery. I love that word. That was like, mystery. I love that. That's a flag word to me. If I read, when I see the word anomaly in the more in a stiffer literature, or when I see it in the pocket, I see the mystery, you ought to watch out for it. What you've got there most of the time is facts which destroy the theory, but the theory is going to live no matter what. So you just label it the mystery. Real mystery. Reminds me of the discussion I had over while I was in college in the parking lot, my debate over there with this professor, this girl, and not just his wife, his girlfriend, where it's possible to you. You know, it's possible to you. Personal officer of the same sex, I have living words. They were trying to remember, I was so in on it. And I said, I forget this. This is a perfect example of what I
same. You see this one. Now, he was exactly right. He said, I pointed out that abiogenesis, that means life and not life. Abiogenesis. It's ridiculous because in its inception, its continuation, because of the second law of thermodynamics. So any primordial soup, you would not have any kind of primordial soup in collection and integration of matter, you would have disintegration of matter. And they said, and I said, it's the second law of thermodynamics. Ah, they said, because you're still waiting on that. He said, that's the kind of mistake you guys always make. And he said, because the earlier primordial earth conditions were not a closed system. You see, the second law of thermodynamics is in a closed system that matter degrades. He said, it's not a closed system. And he said, because the sun was shining, the infinite energy of the whole system. It's not true, so there's no sun. But all you have, all you do is expand all your larger systems. Well, anyway, he said, if the sun's shining, the input of energy, you got an open system. I said, no, you don't. That's the purpose of an open system. Second place, the sun shining doesn't help anything because unless you have three things, the sun is a very effective degenerating force. Give you something? Because the radiation energy from the sun degrades unless you have, number one, a biological form of an inner working conversion. First thing, it's a biological form exists. Second, it has to have within an inner conversion machine to convert the energy, like photosynthesis, to convert the energy to make it integrated, not degenerated. And you have to have information, antecedent, inner, inside information in the machine to guide the process. That's DNA. Get that? Good. Sunshine, but why do you ever take your plant to the beach? Take some day to give you a scientific experiment to show you what I'm talking about, okay? This is not a science course, so I'll explain what I mean. Experiment sometime. Take your favorite house plant that went out in the sun to the beach and lay out in the sun together. It'll turn green, it'll turn red. It'll flourish, and you will suffer. Why? Tell you why, because the plant has something that your skin does not have. Because it has within it a mechanism for converting the energy to useful work, take a negative and make it positive. And it's got DNA in its molecular structure so that it got it to positive. It creates this vein in the plant, this color. It's like software in a computer over there. Now, the reason your skin blisters is that there's nothing, your skin has neither, so it degenerates, it breaks down. The sun breaks down the molecular structure of your skin. It's called a sunburn or a blister. The difference. Well, anyway, I pointed this out. I said, without the mechanism and the information, all you've got is a high, deficient system to degenerate, not to generate. Never get the answer. You see that for a minute. And his girlfriend, She said, you're quiet for a second. And then she said, okay, she said, that's right. Let's admit that's a small problem. She said her husband to her friend. Okay, let's be honest. Let's admit that is a small problem. That's why I call it a signal of Titanic, the bullet cancer. It's a small problem, yes. Yeah, that's a tiny problem. That's why. That's what she was saying, but not just a minor difficulty, in a larger circuit. A minor difficulty in the context of a huge circuit is not what it is. That's roughly analogous to going to the junkyard and you're kicking through the dirt and you kick up an old rusty, battered, half eaten away radiator cap. And you pick it up and you say, I'm almost got a new Cadillac. It's a licking problem. It's not far away. Most of it, we can just call it a Cadillac. Well, we're close enough.
that'd be even worse. That's like saying, I've got everything, you follow me? You're talking about abiogenesis. That's like saying, I've got everything, but I've got everything for the answer except the answer. That's the kind of thinking, reading on my point, I'll give that illustration.
When you said that, I thought that's a minor problem. I got past that. I got a truly straight face.
But what he's saying is, the scientist must parrot this theory cheerfully the moment it is proved to be contrary to any fact, great or small. She was calling it a small problem. Actually, usually it was not. Listen, it was not a small. She was treating it as if it were a minor hitch, an anomaly. Anomaly means an exception, or something that doesn't fit. She was treating it as a minor anomaly than a larger certainty. As a matter of fact, that was the whole question of abiogenesis, and that's the whole issue. You don't have to say, well, I got the sun and I got some slime. I got a lot. No. Just say, give me the sun, give me slime, give me time. I'll give you a man. You understand? That's like saying, like, you pick up the hub at the radio cap and say, you know, I'm almost there. Now, I'm not trying to entertain you guys. I'm trying to see, show you the structure of this, what he said. This is what he is saying. And he having read through this body of literature, the bibliography back here, he's saying, these guys are not holding this with a light hand. You see, that's a very important point, that last one. It does underline the words great or small. It does not take, in science, it does not take 100 exceptions to destroy a law. It takes one. It takes one exception to destroy a fact or a law. Yes?
So wouldn't that be like the same as the inverse concept? With the evidence, you know, some kind of contrary to the evidence in both cases.
That's right. And it doesn't take much. Well, and this is what is practiced. This is what is practiced in other fields of science, but systematically, very often. Okay, any questions on that? So, notice how slow we're going? This has been a world study, we've been on, sort of paces by now, so it's slow. Now, we're talking about hypothesis, theory, fact, and law. In this jump between the theory and fact, Macbeth's observations are very much to the point. He's exactly right about that. And keep in mind that if that kind of discipline, if that kind of restraint were not practiced in the field of medicine, we'd still be treating people with leeches. Maybe more would go well. You just simply have to have that kind of discipline. That's why I read an article in the newspaper, and when this debate was led, he goes to the editors. He's a simple star with aesthetic as him to the inversely to the degree of their rationality. But anyway, this one rather writer said that evolution is a fact, it's like gravity is a fact. And that shows a total ignorance of the whole subject.
Is this helping you all? You keeping this straight in your mind?
Okay, well, you've got to think with me through this and understand this. For a process, now H, to be scientific, quote, end quote, it must move within the framework of four principles. Objectivity, empiricism, parsimony, and convergence. Number one, objectivity. Existing outside the mind as an actual object is not merely within the mind as an idea. Objectivity. That's why we see science is a very narrow field. It's got to exist. For instance, let me ask you this. Suppose I said to you, Mark, I said, you know, guess what happened? I came in early this morning before the sun was up in the office. Halfway between the building and my car up there, I saw a ghost. Could you prove I didn't? I mean, I did.
So,
No. I'm not that weak to say that. Could you prove scientifically that I didn't? Suppose I ridiculed you and said, you can't prove scientifically I didn't. Therefore, I did. What would be your proper response?
Can you
prove scientifically that you did? Could I prove scientifically that I did? Never. Even if I could show you a ghost, I couldn't prove that one appeared to me. Right? So that's outside the field of science. My point is. Now, does that prove that ghosts don't exist? No. It does not prove that I saw one. It does not prove that I didn't see one. It is not a scientific consideration. Science is too narrow to address that. Why? Objectivity is my point here. Objectivity. Science can only deal with that which is objective, the data, something you can observe outside of it. Notions, whims, impressions do not fit. That's all I have. Yes?
If you can prove something scientifically, then you also get proof.
If by its nature it cannot be disproved scientifically, it cannot be proved scientifically. It's called subject to be science. It has to be subject to falsification. That is, if the method that proves it to be true could not have proven it to be false, were it false, it is not science. Something else outside of science. You get what I'm saying? It's called, for something to be scientific, by the way, Karl Popper, and his saying that when Karl Popper says that evolution can never be anything but a theory of biology, this is his primary argument, as I've kind of read it for a long time. That is, that the theory of evolution is not subject to falsification. That is, if you want to find out, is something true? You had a method of investigation, of examination, to see if it's true. If that same method could not show that it's false, were it false, then it is not science. It is not subject to falsification. Therefore, creationism is not science in that sense, in that narrow sense. There is no such thing as creation science in the narrow sense. There is creation science in the same sense that there is evolutionary science. Now, you got that from the same level?
Let's flip that around. There in science, are there things that can be proven false that cannot be proven true?
No, not theoretically. That is, if the method. So what I'm saying is, there probably are. The question is, could the method show one or the other? That's what you have to have that to be science. So it would be subject, in that case, all you need to be versed in, if I understand your question, you have to say it to be subject to verification.
Well, I'm saying, an idea or a theory, mm-hmm. are there not those that exist to be proven false scientifically? Maybe you could be proven true.
No, not happy.
At least not yet.
No, by the very nature. That is, the key word there is scientifically. That might be proven false in other ways.
Yeah.
But not scientifically. The method, in other words, you got that X, this hypothesis, X, might be true or false. If the method, if it is true, the method has to show that it's true, or if it's false, it's the same method to show that it's false. Method of investigation. You cannot do both. That is, if it is true or if it is false, it's not science. Not a technical sense. Did I ask you a question that I avoided?
Yeah,
you may be hung up on the idea of all kinds of things can be proven true or false, but not necessarily scientifically.
Correct, we give an example. Robinson Crusoe landed on his island, and he found proof that somebody was there. Right? What was proof? The footprint wasn't his. Footprint wasn't his, so there was somebody there. He had scientific evidence that at least one man on the island had it at one time. Now, could he have proved that there was nobody on the island? Yeah. Scientifically. Yeah, you have to have more information.
And you have to be looking at yourself and that you can prove that how you fall.
Yeah, that is, he would have to see, he would have to be able to observe the whole island at the same time and see that there's either man or footprint. Then he would have scientific evidence that there's nobody else in town than him, but he. Now, which proves a couple of things. My point is that you have to have, the method is observation. You have to work both ways. Now, another thing, this is an aside, this is not what we're talking about here, that shows how much harder it is to prove a negative. It's easier to prove what is true than what's not true. You have to know a whole lot more to know what is not true than you have to know what is true. Don't worry about that now. But you got the point. Yes, understand the importance of his question and Dan's both good questions. Understand this, that is creation a scientific theory in the pure sense? The answer is no, it is not. Now keep in mind, as Butch brought out, all the evidence for creation is not from the area of science. Do we observe things that make creationism a probable view? Yes. Objectively. We're not looking for those. You can read about them. But what we're talking about is that it can never be, we cannot go back and reproduce an event, a one-time event in the past by its very nature. Therefore, it is not subject to falsification. That is, the theory of creationism, if you want to call it the biological theory, I think a good one, is not subject to falsification. You cannot show that it could not have happened. But neither is evolution. Neither are subject to falsification. Now, all you can show is, in either case, what probably happened. But keep in mind, that is the nature of most of our knowledge. Very little of our knowledge is objective, if anything. Historical knowledge. Do you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Is that based on observation or probability or historical probability? Historical probability. Why? Because here's the thing. You see, for John and Peter, it was scientific. But for us, it's historical.
What about the observation of eyewitnesses? Where does that come in?
For them, it was scientific. They saw it. It was objective. They saw it. See, they're dead. And we have their testimony. But for us, it's historical.
Well, why would it be scientific?
Pardon?
Why would...
No, because Thomas saw him and touched him.
Observation. Would that be fact?
Yes.
Okay.
It'd be a scientific fact, not a historical fact. My point. Now keep asking this question. What you do? This is what you're doing a good job. You've got to keep this sorted out in your mind. See? All we're talking about here is the scientific question of creation. See, creation does it with revelation, does it all kinds of things. This is just one narrow aspect of it. All I'm saying is, insofar, you can come back to this point again so we keep our perspective, insofar as creationism touches biology. It is a theory of biology, just like evolution is. Insofar as it touches biology, but the doctrine of creation, the broad doctrine, covers anything. Anything from the barrel. That has nothing to do with science. Yes?
If it can suggest that inherently we can do it wrong, then it doesn't come to science.
And science in the pure sense. Yeah, that's very important because you notice where you were using science kind of we're not equivocating, we're using it in the broad and the narrow sense. Because I do that because that's the way it's used in our culture. This is the language we speak. Go ahead, John.
Okay, and that has everything to do with our activity.
Yes. So science, for instance, I don't believe evolutionary science, if you want to call it that, is objective. But it is the very nature of an objective. For instance, in my field, the area where I have special knowledge is in human evolution. I raise the question, why is it that you will find a little chunk of a jaw about that big, a piece of skull about that big around, and if you draw pictures, draw the whole thing, put him in line, and put him in the bucket. And over here, you got the Polish of our fossils and some Socrates story man, others, I'll go into that. Very, on whole skeletons, pre Neanderthal. Whole skeleton. They may not get in the book, no picture, they don't get in the book at all. How come the whole skeleton gets left out and this little piece of jawbone gets drawn and extrapolated and put in? The answer is, you can draw this to fit the scheme. But this contradicts it. This is one of those facts greater than all. So it just conveniently gets left out, unless you get the more technical books. You realize that there's all kinds of human fossil evidence, but this doesn't get in the book. I asked my professor about that. He said, yeah, no, sir. When we look at human evidence, I'm going to show you how they even rearrange them, they switch them around. That's not being objective. That's why. I'm just talking about that particular field. Fascinating. Okay, objectivity. Secondly, empirical, yes.
Because of objectivity, then science is subject to falsification.
Yes. That you can observe something that says it's either true or not true. Or likely. Or in the case of evolution or creation, Joe, likely to be true or not true. Second, empiricism, the use of methods based on experiment and observation.
Let me give you an example.
Very simple. You believe life came from non-life? Oh, yes. There's fear. No. There's nobody who saw it. No. Does it fit any criteria of biology that we do? No. Well, we know it. Never happened. Not wrong with it. Does it normally, you got this life and non life? You ever see it happen? No. You ever know anybody who saw it? No. Does it normally happen? No. Do you have any evidence that it ever happened? Well, we're here, aren't we? Well, that doesn't prove how we got it, like we're here. Or you cannot be scientific. That's like this, just give me a fact, give me one fact. With the evidence, empiricism. Third, parsimony. That means stinginess. Offering as a hypothesis the alternative enjoying the fewest unresolved variables, or having the highest degree of probability, the most natural and simple explanation. That is, this is it. Where you have uncontrovertible scientific fact, and aren't there any examples of that, comparatively speaking? Then you're on safe ground. But most of the time, you're not dealing with hard, incontrovertible facts. You're dealing with probabilities. Therefore, the general rule of science, parsimony, is that if you have a number of possible explanations, that experience and the very nature of things dictates that normally we look at the simplest first. Analysis and hermeneutics, what the hermeneutics last word is. The clearest interpretation is suited to the right one. The scripture, the clearest of alternatives, is there might be three or four possible things, usually the simplest. Called, by the way, in Bacon, we got this in Bacon, it's called Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the right one. Doesn't mean it's in any areas we don't have hard, observable, incontrovertible facts.
then you have to take three possibilities. You start off with the assumption that the simplest one answer is the correct answer, and you leave that only when you're forced to by further investigation. Then you move on. You move from the simplest to the more complex. You don't take the most complex one. Take an example. Yeah, this is ridiculous. Well, that one city chuckle. How did it happen? In the north, it's March. You got a very simple explanation. What is it? Freezing fall, right? Freezing fall. Is it only possible ever to get there? Could be a meteor. It's a meteor. That is it possible to meteor? Yeah.
Okay.
There's, you heard of the mad chuckle there? You got this guy in the house. They got up here, ha ha. Every once in a while, he sits over the wall and he chuckles. So they pass that in the heart and it could be the man chuckle digger. Maybe possible. Now, if you're a Christian scientist, it may not even be there. No chuckles at all. I was listening to the Prairie Home Companion Saturday night. They were doing part of a chuckle, and Lake Wobegon had snow, late snow, and covered the chuckle. They might have forgot where they were. And his monologue on Lake Wobegon days was there's a deal about all the different things happening in the chuckle. How it changed the life. But anyway, that's like my point. Now, we've got three possibilities for the chuckle, right? This is normal thought. Either it's freezing thaw or a meteor with a mad chuckle. Well, which do you think happened well? Until we have some real good evidence, we're going to operate scientifically, not rationally. We would assume that the normal freezing thaw created the chuckle, right? Now, does it mean that there couldn't have been a mad, a crazy man doing chuckles or a meteor? No. But we go to that explanation only with some very good evidence. We have to have some real hard evidence. If somebody did see a crazy fellow at the time, get out and dig chuckles, three or four people saw him. They caught him. Oh, we know that this chuckle didn't come the wrong way. Or maybe if some people saw the meteor hit. But unless you've got some good evidence, you just don't assume the more unlikely prospects. That's science. Not evolutionary science, but it's science. For instance, to give an example, and I keep coming back to it, but I think this is the area where the battle is being fought. If you get tired of this. Simple as this. You take the simplest one cell creature, the amoeba, the information in the DNA in that, if printed out, would make several volumes in the encyclopedia. It would create several volumes on books the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The information would print it out. Now, if you have information of that order, you have, and you want to ask the question, what is the source of that information? Then we would hearken on human experience, what we would call normal thought, and we would say that where, in every case where we have found information, high level information, we have found behind it, we have found antecedent to it, we have found as its source intelligence. Right? We have no example. There's been nothing observed. Or in the natural order, the history of man, where you had high-level information that did not emit from redundant. There was not an emission of intelligence. You find a book, you say behind that book is what? An author. You find a clock, you say behind the clock is the clockmaker. a design. That's the simplest explanation. So, when you find that, if you find the book, you say, is it possible, to hear the old story in Hoyle, the book I'm going to work with you later on, talks about this. Is it possible when you find a copy of Shakespeare that was produced by a bunch of monkeys, you know, locked up in typewriters, randomly hitting the keys, somehow accidentally produced Shakespeare? It was the 12th night. No, it's impossible. Only in the dream world, not really. So, whatever we find, how that information, we find a set of encyclopedia, six volumes, we say behind that information is intelligence. Well, why then, when you find information of the same order, in fact, as a matter of fact, of a vastly higher order in DNA, what is the normal, what is the parsimonious, one our word, what is the parsimonious assumption? That behind the information you have, intelligence. Unless you're a total chance organic evolution. Then, behind the information you have what?
What?
Chance, the all human, yeah. Chance. That's why we're going to see Fred Hoyle, one of the world's leading astronomers, has written a book called The Intelligent Universe, in which he said, let's quit kidding ourselves. There has to be intelligence greater than on Earth somewhere out there. There's a God, but he lives in intelligence. Why? Because you don't have information without intelligence. You don't have information. We all know that without intelligence, you have chaos. For the monkey, chimpanzee, putting on an IBM typewriter, you do not get grammar, syntax. You get noise and random. You don't get 4 score and 7 years ago, you get whatever. You're trying to be it. Now, therefore, you see, parsimonious. Scientific creationism, insofar as it is science, in the sense that it's science, is the parsimonious view. Why? Well, you have intelligence. He had information and intelligence. In the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. That's the most parsimonious explanation. And convergence. The proper interrelating or putting together of data. That is, take data from one area of observation and you correlate it, you integrate it with the data from another area. This medicine does this. Well, the space program, by the way, I am amazed by the technology of the space program. And it is highly, one of the things that's in it is highly integrated. For instance, you look at when the Challenger went up, despite, well, let's talk about the 25 successful launches. And think about the different, you had to have air cybernetics, the computer sciences, had to be integrated with metallurgy. Think of the metallurgy that's involved in creating the materials. And the chemistry, and the metallurgy, but the chemistry that's involved in creating the materials and the and the mathematics that's involved, and the guidance systems, and the whole thing. It's a marvelous integration of information from various fields. Amazing. I think a few. Well, even with the modern automobile, is that integration of all kinds of less science. Now, last thing I want to point out, well, any questions on that? I think the next thing we're going to discuss is quite lengthy with the unit, and I don't want to get started and interrupt it. But any questions on the cover thus far? Are y'all still with me? I don't know if it's that hard. I'm
trying to get you down. So when you debate an evolution of it, all you do is really show that theory is self-defeating.
Well, I, in a way.
That's not all I do.
Well, I mean,
no. I would show that if you debate it on the scientific level, then what you do is show the data, look at the data, and ask the question, what is the most parsimonious or the most probable interpretation of the data? And the truth or falsehood of the of evolution or creation stands on the which has the highest degree of probability, since you cannot experimentally reproduce and you can't in the past. By very nature, either one. Anyone that? Both are theories, philosophies of biology, insofar as creationism is limited biology, which it isn't, but insofar as it is. It's a question of probabilities. If you have intelligent life, the question is, what is the question of origins? What's the most probable source of intelligent life? Mathematically probable, biologically probable, genetically probable, thermodynamically probable. What does the fossil evidence show? And so forth. You see the nature? You just cut each area. Well, you're showing these probabilities. Now, you must understand that probabilities can become virtual. Now listen to me. You must understand this, because I fear you have the impression that the basis of our belief is less firm than you thought it was coming into this class. It isn't. Because, listen to me, probabilities become virtual certainties. Virtual means not actual, but functioning as certainty. By the way, that is true in most of life. We have probability becoming virtual certainties. So that I think creationism is probably a virtual certainty. Because the lines of evidence of observation converge so that while we cannot observe it and know it as a scientific fact in a pure sense, the probability of danger becomes a virtual certainty. Understand? And that's true. Our belief in the resurrection is a virtual certainty. Do we know that Jesus rose from the dead?